And now, the Low Post.
Welcome to a special. I should have already been on vacation, but my daughter got a fever right before we went to the airport edition of the Low Post podcast. I don't even know what day it is. All the days have started to blend into one another in the Low household, but this delay to my vacation has allowed me to talk about a couple of teams I was kind of interested in talking about anyway, and that made an interesting trade. And to talk about the Thunder end of it, our OKC insider, all-around great guy, Royce Young. How you doing?
I am excellent, Zach. I couldn't be more honored that I ended up falling into this just haphazardly by all the unfortunate issues that have befallen your family. I get to take advantage of it by joining the Low Post, so it's an incredible honor.
Children, they don't tell you these things in television shows and movies that they tell you that they get viruses and stuff, but she woke up from her nap. Today's Tuesday. On Wednesday, we were supposed to fly to Zurich and stay in what Katie Nolan just described to me. She doesn't know the hotel. She's like, she said, is there a dope ass hotel room somewhere not being used? I said, that's exactly what's happening. And she had a fever. And you can't fly with the kid that has a fever. You just can't. It's not good for the kid, and it's not good for the passengers. It's just not good. And the fever wouldn't go away. Has your kid ever had roseola, this virus roseola?
I've never even heard of that one. He's had some viruses, but roseola, I've never heard of that.
Apparently this one and the hoof and mouth disease, or the foot and mouth disease, which sounds like something that should have been eradicated by penicillin like 100 years ago, are going around my neighborhood. So that's what she's fine now, but we're
so roseola not. Is hand, foot, and mouth. That's the same thing.
No, they're different, but they're separate viruses.
Cousins.
But you get a fever, and then the fever lasts, and then you get a rash, and then the rash goes away. We're in the rash going away segment of
right.
Also a fun bonus. One of the symptoms of roseola, as I guess is probably the symptom of many disease of many viruses for children, is that they become extra irritable. I'm frightened of my daughter. This is not going to be the first time. And I think in every phase of life, there are going to be periods where having a daughter is like, she frightens me. Like teenage,
right.
When she's a teenager, I'm like 100% going to be frightened of her. No question. She's growling at me like a dog almost. Like
right.
when I ask her to do, I'm like, this is unpleasant. You're being unpleasant. Anyway.
Well, I would say irritability, Zach, is also a symptom of a close cousin of all this, which is called toddlerism. So it's very hard to decipher between toddlerism, because that's also a symptom of when they get irritable.
She told me I offered to help her get dressed this morning, and she told me, "You will never ever help me again." And I was like, "That's really mean." I said, "You hurt Daddy's feelings. You hurt Daddy's. Daddy's really sad." And then she growled like some sort of like a badger or something. It was very unpleasant. Anyway,
well, enjoy your flight to Zurich then.
that's a lot of that burden falls on mommy. Anyway, it'll be fun.
Speaking of irritability, Carmelo Anthony. No, I'm just kidding.
That's what we're going to talk about. So we have a three-way trade that I haven't really gotten a chance to talk about yet.
Mm-hmm.
I think people know the parameters of it now. Carmelo Anthony joins Rasheed Wallace in the illustrious Hawks Hall of Fame and will soon be a Houston Rocket, according to essentially everyone. And very interestingly, the Thunder, rather than stretch Carmelo Anthony, found a trade partner for him and found someone they wanted to take back, and that's Dennis Schroeder, another point guard who needs the ball a lot with a shaky jump shot. I think this is going to be really interesting. He's obviously going to come off the bench. I believe it was reported that they were able to meet with him before doing the trade, so that was discussed. He appears to have been amenable to that. I have to give Sam Presti credit in this sense. He keeps spinning these, distressed is the wrong word, but like not super valuable assets into other stuff. Like Reggie Jackson about to get paid became Enes Kanter,
right.
Became Carmelo Anthony, became Dennis Schroeder. At some point, it feels like the music has to stop, and they will end up with a complete lemon, and maybe that's what's happened here. But I think this is a really interesting move. What is your sort of feel for this roster right now as we approach essentially the end of team building for the summer?
Well, that's a great description of it, Zach. I mean, that really is kind of what Presti does. He's kind of flipping houses, right? I mean, he's You know, he kind of just a distressed asset is one way to look at it, and that's really what happened here with this trade. Is that, you know, in the interim, the Thunder could have saved more money if they would have stretched and waived Carmelo Anthony. But that,
yeah, they've essentially decided we are okay paying Dennis Schroeder $6 million a year. That's the difference between his salary and what Carmelo's cap hit would have been had they stretched him. I know some people don't buy that math. Or don't view that as the proper way to value a trade like this. I happen to think in this case it's convincing to me that that's a fair way to look at paying Dennis Schroeder.
Well, and it's also the other aspect to that I think might get overlooked a little bit is that that $5.5-6 million there is a live asset that can also now be flipped again. Whether that's, you know, whether you just have to get off the contract, whether you. Maybe Dennis Schroeder plays really well in Oklahoma City, buys into his role, wants to be a starter again. Somebody wants a point guard, and you can move Schroeder into somebody else's roster. And while if you would have stretched Carmelo Anthony, again, you save more money today on the surface of it all, but now you've got a $9.3 million dead cap hit over 3 years that just sticks with you, and you can't do anything about it. So now they like Schroeder, and that's the reason that, you know, they looked at all their options, Zach. They looked at a number of different moves to take back, you know, a player that they would have, you know, could have stretched and waived at a lower number that they could have bought out. I mean, they looked at a lot of different things, but what they settled on is that they like Dennis Schroeder. He's a 24-year-old starting point guard in the NBA. He comes with baggage. He comes with issues, and that's the reason he was available for Carmelo Anthony and a protected first-round pick. I mean, this guy's a good basketball player, but his trade value was chopped down because of some off-the-court issues, some in-the-locker-room issues. And, you know, there's a lot of spin coming out of Oklahoma City that Billy Donovan has met and talked with him, Sam Presti's talked with him, and that there's going to be some buy-in there with his role. And they envision the guy as, you know, a sixth man. And you mentioned Reggie Jackson, but they really are trying to kind of recreate that position that they had with Reggie Jackson, and then, of course, with the all-timer of James Harden. But Reggie Jackson's kind of a more similar fit there, a more similar comparison in that, yeah, doesn't shoot it well, not a great catch-and-shoot guy, but you can play him off the ball, and you can play him alongside Russell Westbrook, because that's what they envision, Zach. They don't see this as a backup point guard situation. They see this as a 20 to 25-minute-a-night guy that can finish in closing lineups with Russell Westbrook, which is something that they want. And they also are trying to solve the perpetual issue in Oklahoma City, which is this team just completely diving off a cliff when Russell Westbrook sits. It was an issue again last season, and it was obviously an issue the year before that. They have tried to figure out a way for this team to be good when Russell Westbrook goes to the bench. And just simply staggering Paul George and Russell Westbrook, that wasn't the solution. So Dennis Schroeder might be able to alleviate some of that.
You know how my daughter has a rash right now? Do you break out in any sort of involuntary, either like a rash or some sort of physical or verbal reaction when the words Samaje Kristen is said to you? Like, do you immediately, like, does something happen to your body? You know, speaking of when they completely collapsed without Russell Westbrook, that dude played in the playoffs.
Yeah. Talk about irritability.
Went very badly. Well, let's start simple, because you're 100% right that part of the selling process with Schroeder was you're going to play crunch time.
Yeah.
A lot. So if crunch time includes Schroeder, Westbrook, George, probably Adams, I don't know who the fifth guy is. If it's Roberson, that means Roberson is essentially playing the four. So start. We can talk about that, or we could talk about
Grant.
I don't know who the fourth star, the fifth starter is going to be. Who's going to start at power forward for the Thunder, or who's going to start? Who's going to be the, you know, like Westbrook, Roberson, George, Adams? I think are going to be starters. Mm-hmm. Who's the fifth one?
I would say it's Patrick Patterson.
I would agree that is the leading candidate right now.
He was the guy that was going to start when they signed him a summer ago, and then they traded for Carmelo Anthony, and things changed quickly on that front. Billy Donovan loves Patrick Patterson, recruited the guy, knows him well, knows him before, you know, Patterson came to Oklahoma City, and Patterson really fits a lot of checks a lot of boxes that Billy Donovan wants in a starting power forward, in a lot of the ways that Carmelo Anthony wasn't able to, which is, first of all, Patterson, when you're playing heavy minutes alongside Russell Westbrook and Paul George, you're not going to see a lot of shots, and you have to be okay with the fact that you might take, you might play 22 minutes and take four shots in the game. And for Billy Donovan, as long as all four of those shots are threes or even better corner threes, and that's something Patrick Patterson is pretty good at, that's fine. But Patterson is a very good ball mover. He can catch it. He can, you know, take one dribble, hand it off, move it to the other side of the floor. You know, he's an adequate pick and roll defender. So he can do a lot of simple things, and he can kind of get the Thunder into what they really want, Zach, which is kind of their rotations and their depth, and they can kind of plug and play with different lineups based, because that's what Sam Presti's really always been trying to build. And again, with this team, is just hand Billy Donovan a roster with a lot of different combinations, and he can figure out which one works. And they put a lot of trust in Donovan to do that on a nightly basis. Doesn't always hit the mark, but at least in terms of starting five, Patterson's just kind of the guy that can kind of get you into your nightly rotations.
Well, they need someone other than Paul George who can shoot threes. And Westbrook still is not really a three-point shooter. He'll sure as hell take a lot of them. He'll take 20 in a game if necessary.
He's been working on it this summer, I've been told. That's been a big-time off-season focus. We'll see.
What is this, his 10th season or something?
I know. They want him to be a stress – what they've stressed, Zach, is a work on a catch-and-shoot. Become a little bit better of a catch-and-shoot guy. But obviously, in order to do that, there needs to be a catching before the shooting. And it's hard to catch it from yourself.
Yeah, you need to pass it to another player who then passes it back to you, as I understand it. The Patterson version of that starting five, the one that you're predicting and I am also predicting will open the season, played 8 minutes last season. And Patterson and Adams, I thought it was quite interesting. You mentioned the unexpected Melo acquisition. Patterson and Adams barely played together, and part of that was that Patterson wasn't very good. Grant was very good, and Grant and Patterson was a pairing that Billy ended up liking. I wonder how much we'll see the Grant version, which is really there's just no shooting other than Paul George in that you know, Russ, Robertson, PG, Grant, Adams.
Right.
That played 36 minutes. I just don't know. They're going to need somebody, and I feel like we've been saying this for 5 years, they're going to need someone who can shoot to pop on this team, and I don't know if there's any candidate that's even realistic. Like I actually kind of liked what I saw from Ferguson last year, just in terms of a sort of a feel and on both ends of the floor. I thought he moved his feet pretty well on defense and feels the game pretty well. Whether he can shoot immediately this year, I don't know. Abrines, I just have sort of given up on Abrines ever earning what I would consider a consistent, trusted role on the team. Maybe that happens this year. They do not have enough shooting, and I think they're going to be a really good team. Like I think they're going to be a tough, nasty, great defensive team. And Russ has a history of these, or Russ and the team have a history of these lineups that don't look like they should be able to score enough points, because sometimes literally nobody can shoot scoring enough points, at least in the regular season, because he's so damn good and they play with such a fury and they force turnovers and they get out in transition and all that. I don't know how well it works in the playoffs, but I think the Thunder are going to be better than people think maybe in the regular season. That said, I just, you know, the shooting is just this sort of intractable problem that never seems to be solved.
Right. And even when they tried to solve it with what they thought would be one of the smartest catch and shoot moves that they could make and adding Carmelo Anthony, that didn't really work out either. And I don't know if it's just, you speak of viruses, I don't know if it's a virus in Oklahoma City that you show up and you're unable to shoot anymore, but Carmelo definitely did not fill that role in terms of what they envisioned, because they, you know, and here's the kind of the sad irony, Zach, is that last year you can make a case that was really one of the best shooting seasons ever in Oklahoma City, because, you know, they set their highest mark ever in the OKC era for threes made in a game, and I think they topped it twice, which is, it was 17, then it was 18, and then I think they hit 19 threes in a game, which, again, when you're comparing against some of the other upper echelon shooting teams in the NBA, that sounds kind of comical to say that that's as good as it gets, but for the Thunder, for a team that's never been able to really shoot, those were kind of achievements in a way. But they're going to struggle with that, but you mentioned it, Zach. Russell Westbrook teams, they score through attrition. They just like force the ball in the basket at times and somehow kind of produce points even when it's not really pretty or the way that you would necessarily plan it to be. But This is what Billy Donovan's going to have to try to kind of figure out. And you mentioned Alex Zabrinas. They have this kind of fantasy that he is going to be a guy that can kind of sit on the wing and be able to stretch the floor. They advertised him as this guy that could kind of bring an element that they never had, which was somebody that really moves well without the ball, and, you know, not necessarily in a Redick or Korver way, but, you know, he would kind of create gravity and he'd move around the floor. Well, he did not live up to that. He does not move well without the ball. And to me, it's not a shooting issue with Alex Zabrinas.
He can shoot. He can shoot.
He just can't get shots. I mean, he can't get open. And also he can't stay on the floor because of some of the other areas.
Well, they've never been guardable ever when they surround Russ and Adams with three shooters and just run spread, pick and roll. They've never, ever been defendable. They just can't get to those lineups. And you know, that was one of the reasons why Melo looked like he would be an okay fit there. And honestly, like, he didn't play well. Defensively, he's obviously a disaster. Like, he couldn't even hang against Utah in the playoffs, let alone what the Rockets are going to ask him to do against better competition. But I actually don't – starting around December, you know, I remember his, like, isolations per game all of a sudden dove in half, and his catch-and-shoot threes spiked. And it was like he didn't shoot as well as you would expect, and he still took some tough shots, and his finishing around the rim, you know, weirdly sort of waxed and waned. I don't think offensively – maybe he wasn't happy. Part of this is, like, if the player is grumbling or unhappy, either publicly, as in Melo's case, or behind the scenes, that could just take a toll on the environment of a team. I actually don't think he was as terrible – this, like, completely – awful fit who was reluctant to do what was asked of him, or at least in terms of the execution of it. And look, I don't know what the hell he thinks is going to happen in Houston, but that's what he's going to be asked to be, catch and shoot Carmelo. He doesn't appear to like that very much.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that kind of unfortunately happened, Zach, in kind of the wake of Carmelo sounding off after the season and talking about his role and how he wasn't necessarily all that thrilled with what transpired in Oklahoma City, is that the narrative kind of got rewritten on Melo's year with the Thunder. And the reality is that he bought into the role. And everybody talked about Melo's just unwillingness to change, and he won't do it. Well, he wouldn't, and I think a lot of people are kind of putting him in the box of saying that it's because he wouldn't come off the bench. Yeah, that's a bridge too far for Carmelo Anthony, and it certainly was in Oklahoma City. He was unwilling to take that medicine and go as far to do that. But in terms of accepting what Billy Donovan was asking him to do, he did it. I mean, he really made the effort to try to become, quote-unquote, Olympic Melo. He just wasn't good at it in a lot of different ways. And you mentioned it. I think that, you know, whether there's a human element here, and Carmelo Anthony has spent his whole life having the ball in his hands, and this is something he talked about, Billy Donovan talked about, is that when he'd go, you know, 2, 3, 4 minutes at a time without much less a shot but just a touch, you know, and that's Russell Westbrook's fault, that's Carmelo's fault, that's Donovan's fault, that's Paul George's fault, that's everybody's fault. But he just couldn't really just stay in the kind of necessary rhythm. And there was always this kind of forced element to when he did get a shot. And I don't think Carmelo was ever quite comfortable, but they played well at times. They really got rolling there late in December, early in January, before Robertson got hurt. But, you know, I think that there's kind of been this rewritten story about Melo, that he just wouldn't change in Oklahoma City and it never would work and he didn't fit. I think it's actually he fit a lot better than people think. He was just never personally happy with it. He never felt great about it, and he kind of accepted it through gritted teeth, and all that kind of came to a head in the playoff series against the Jazz. And then, of course, he aired it out publicly after the season.
Against the Jazz, their offense fell apart. They scored 100.7 points per 100 possessions, which essentially is dead last in the NBA after being a decent offensive team. And that's what I could see happening to this team in the playoffs against just a good team. And there isn't going to be anything but good teams in the West, a good defense. The lack of shooting, it just becomes so much harder. But obviously he was unplayable defensively in that series too. Russ and PG last year without Melo in about 400 minutes, 110 points per 100 possessions, 96 allowed. That is very encouraging. I think they're going to be a very good defensive team. Here's one for you. What is Nerlens Noel's role going to be? Are we assuming he's like 12 minutes a game backup center? Because they didn't really have a traditional quote unquote backup center. It was sort of Patterson plus Grant, the combination of them.
Right.
Grant, the center on offense, playing that role anyway, and Patterson often playing that role on defense. Like, Is it like a lock that he plays? Is he going to be penciled in as a traditional backup center right off the bat?
I mean, that's a good question, and I think that what they sold to him was certainly a very stable, consistent role, because you know there's talk out there that he was offered more money in other places, but he wanted Oklahoma City because he felt like that he would get playing time, he'd get consistent minutes, and it was kind of a organizational stability maybe that he good. And his representation were looking for.
So, good hot dogs in the media room. How are the hot dogs? Are there hot dogs?
I don't think they do hot dogs.
They don't have the movie theater rotating disgusting hot dogs that just sit there and you don't know.
No, they don't have those. Good salad bar. They do a good media salad bar, so maybe he could show up and get some croutons or something at halftime. I don't know, but I mean, I don't know what the role. I mean, look, Zach. If he fits the identity of what Sam Presti is kind of trying to really hammer home, which is long, switchy, athletic, fast. You know, pacey, all these type of things that Presti is really trying to hammer home with the identity of the team. But look, they're going to play Steven Adams a lot of minutes. I mean, and they're going to play Jeremy Grant a lot of minutes. And you know, they're going to play Paul George at the four some. So you know, they're going to start Patterson, I think, like we both think. So there's going to be some spots for Nerlens Noel, but I think some of it's just going to be completely based on the fact of like how well does he play and. You know, does he earn the time that he gets? So
he's got to earn it. He's got to earn it. Yeah. If there's one thing that I'm a little bit, if there's one thing I'm fed up with on NBA Twitter, boy, do I sound old. One of the many things I'm fed up with is this idea that like Nerlens Noel has been a good NBA player held back by his franchises. I do believe that somewhere within Nerlens Noel is a good NBA player. We have certainly seen. A quarter here, a quarter there, a highlight here, a highlight there. These teams are not just like, he wasn't like blackballed in Dallas for some nefarious reason. He's not been the most reliable teammate on or off the court. He does not execute the scheme defensively. He's all over the place. He can't shoot. His passing, while, I think the most promising part of his game on offense, or maybe other than rim running, has led to way more turnovers than teams are willing to tolerate. He can't post up. He wants to do more stuff on offense than he's really capable of doing. Like, I he looks like he should be a good NBA player. That is different than actually being a good NBA player that helps you consistently win. He has not been that. And I'm not sure that he's earned much more playing time or deserved much more playing time than he's actually gotten. And that's why I don't assume he goes into next season in the rotation at the start of the season. I hope he does, because I want to see him play. I want to see if he can put it together. But there is this idea that he's been wronged in the NBA, and I just don't think that's correct.
Right. And I mean, look, the Thunder signed him to a minimum deal, so they're on the low risk side of this themselves. And you know, there's an idea out there, and you know, if there's one thing on NBA Twitter that bothers me, Zach, well, it would be that. You know, you make the assumption that the guy is in a contract year, so therefore he will play wonderfully. There's also habits that a player has built up throughout his life. You mentioned some of the kind of grandstanding issues that have followed Nerlens Noel around, and I don't think that those things are just broken by the fact that he is in a contract year. He was in a contract year last year, too, and, you know, that didn't really go all that well for him either. So, yeah, he's on a prove-it deal, and he can show up in Oklahoma City, and he can try to earn himself a new contract for next year, and that's up to him. So he's got to earn it in a lot of different ways. But I think making just this assumption that, yeah, like, that he's in the lineup, that he's in the rotation, and that he's going to play well just because he's in a new circumstance, I think that that's greatly overstated for sure.
I like that you talked about Sam Presti's desire for length and athleticism because, boy, man, we all have types. Sam, God bless him, has got a type. If you're long and you're athletic and you can't really shoot, like, you're going to get a shot on the Thunder at some point in your career. Yeah. Schroeder, for his position, and I would say the same thing about the Magic. I mean, Jeff Weltman and John Hammond have a type. They want everyone to be 7 feet tall and unable to shoot. Schroeder, I actually like TLC as a little bit of a flyer. He's been wildly inconsistent. A way below average jump shooter. He got into the low 30s from three last year and worked really, really hard. The Sixers coaches will rave about how hard he works. I like the way he kind of he'll attack a closeout, and like he can catch and drive like semi-productively, or at least he went through a stretch in the middle of last season when he was doing that. I don't mind that as a Flyer, but he also fits the bill. Can I be boring and defend this trade for both teams?
Yeah, well, that's not what you're really allowed to do, especially when it comes to NBA Twitter, Zach, but I mean, I guess you can.
I don't mind it.
I'll allow it.
I don't mind it for the Thunder. I don't think Dennis Schroeder was good last year. I think Dennis Schroeder has been good in the past and has interesting physical tools. His locker room issues are very well known. Hopefully that will be easier to deal with on a good team, a veteran team, than it was when he was briefly the man in Atlanta. I don't mind it as a talent play. And I've seen, including my friend Bill Simmons, rip the Hawks to shreds for this deal. I'm all right with this for the Hawks. Like, Dennis Schroeder had no trade value. None. Like, they couldn't.
Yeah, exactly. What were they supposed to do?
And they wanted to get rid of him. The Jeremy Lin deal, which I wouldn't have done if I were them, but we'll get to that in a second, completely telegraphed that they had this deal in place when they got Jeremy Lin. They wanted to get rid of Dennis Schroeder. They are doing backflips having accomplished that without attaching one of their own picks. Now, one could argue that I believe they saved the Thunder something like $70 million in this season. And one could argue that a lottery-protected first-round pick is not enough compensation for that. But I think that that's fair. But it's less fair if you view Dennis Schroeder as $45 million of money and player that you do not want on your team, including 15.5 in each of the two seasons after this one. If you view that as an anvil, then this is completely fine return. I do think that pick is fascinating, by the way. Most of these picks that have protection, you know, it's like protection that de-escalates over many years. This is like a one time only. Like if that's a lottery pick in 2022, it doesn't become top 10 protected the next year. It's one time only. It becomes 2 second round picks. I think it's fascinating that the Thunder made it 2022. I think it's fascinating that the Hawks decided 2022 that might be the double draft where we get the high school kids and the one and done kids in the same draft. And I think it signals, I don't think it's controversial to say it. 2022 is going into the last year of Russ's contract.
Exactly.
And it's at the end of PG's. Like, it signals by that point, who the hell knows what we're going to be?
Exactly. There's kind of a tangible window that's been opened here, Zach, and I think that when you look at it and you play it out and you understand that the draft picks of Thunder have kind of got out right now, that they've had a 10-year run of incredible success in Oklahoma City. They've had kind of multiple eras of basketball, and now they're kind of into the prime years of Westbrook's career. They've got Paul George re-signed. They've got Steven Adams. They've got kind of this new core that they're going to rely on for, you know, 2 to 3 to 4 years of what they hope to be high level competitive playoff basketball. And Sam Presti in the Thunder's mind, if it extends past 2022 and it means that they, you know, don't, that lottery pick, conveys to Atlanta, or it, you know, doesn't convey, or whatever you want to, however you want to describe it, then they're pumping their fists in Oklahoma City saying, hey, that means that they're still good and they're still competitive and they're still a playoff team. So something's gone really good there. And maybe Paul George has signed again. Maybe Russell Westbrook is playing really well into his mid-30s. So, I mean, that for them, they view it as, yeah, there's this kind of window of opportunity here where they don't, you know, they no team wants to just willingly give up first-round picks. But if you're a team in Oklahoma City situation, they'd much rather, I think, have a player that they could take a chance on in terms of a talented option that could fill a lot of holes in the immediate future like Dennis Schroeder, rather than holding on to a draft pick in 2022 that – you know, may not really make much of a difference to them in terms of drafting in the 20s or the 25 range or whatever it might be.
Yeah, it's a trade that I'm not like particularly thrilled about it if I'm either team, but I could be satisfied with it if I'm either perspective. And boy, I can't wait to see how the Hawks are next year. And I don't mean that like they're going to be terrible and lose a lot of games. I can't wait to see how Trae Young is, because I've said this before. Say what you want about Travis Schlenk in that trade. I'm not going to pretend to, from what little I've seen of both, I would have taken Doncic probably number one in the draft and been thrilled about it, but I don't know much about these guys relative to NBA players. But you got to say this. That trade took enormous balls because you are a first-time GM, and the safest thing to do is just take Doncic. He falls to three. He's the smart NBA fan's favorite player. He's the most well, he's in a lot of ways more well known than Trae Young. Certainly people are more excited about him. Nobody thinks he's going to be a bust, which some people think Trae Young's right. going to be. The safest thing, you will never get fired for taking Luka Doncic number three, ever. You will get fired for trading down to five and taking Trae Young if Trae Young isn't good and Doncic is awesome. You will get fired. It's just a matter of when. If it may not even matter if you nail some other stuff. That will get you fired, and it will mar the rest of your career. And that is a ballsy, ballsy move. The one thing I wouldn't have done, by the way, the Lin one, I would have just done, like, forget, just do the Denver trade that the Nets did. Like, take Denver's guys into your cap space, take Denver's first-round pick, top 12 protector, whatever it was. Just, like, sign Shabazz Napier as a placeholder for the minimum, or Shane Larkin, or just name a point guard who's available at the minimum. And, like, just, like, all Jeremy Lin's going to do is accidentally win you another game or two next year. And maybe you want – I can see the argument for you can't view the world in those icy cold terms. Like, these young guys need a competent point guard, but maybe more – like, maybe the competency gap between Jeremy Lin and Shabazz Napier is, like, meaningful in that sense of, like, setting up John Collins and helping all those guys develop. I just would rather have the Denver first-round pick. That's my main quibble with the Hawks, other than being wildly interested in how Trae Young turns out. But boy, oh boy, because that is not the safe pick.
Well, if we're talking about Trae Young, I lack all objectivity to be able to discuss him in a reasonable manner, because I'm all aboard. I've been standing for Trae Young since he was a sophomore in high school. So I love the kid. He's a great young man. And I mean, I'm a believer. Again, I'm not the most objective person when it comes to talking about him. But there are a few things in Summer League that I was a little bit, you know, I hate to draw conclusions about Summer League, but I did expect him to beat people off the dribble with a lot more regularity and a lot easier than I think he did. Because in college at OU, in the 1 year at OU, Zach, he just roasted people off the dribble. Even when they'd throw two or three bodies at him, there was just nobody that could stay in front of him. And really what it came down for Trae is that it was about shot selection. It was about decision making. And, you know, I think that he kind of lost contact with some of his teammates in terms of the chemistry on the floor. There was, you know, there might have been some brewing animosity in the locker room. All those factors just about his stardom that kind of exploded. And, you know, you get him on an NBA team. Granted, the Hawks don't have the most talent in the world to surround him with at the present moment, but you get him on an NBA team with a bunch of players that can catch and finish on a more regular basis, and the qualities of Trae Young will shine through. And that's, I think, to me, that's what you're going to see, is you're going to see the best qualities of him, the things, the flashes of just incredible playmaking potential. The best quality to me, Zach, about Trae Young is, I mean, he has elite vision, and his ability to throw ahead and create quick, easy points just based on – it looks like such a simple play, but, like, you know, Russell Westbrook's been great at that. He'll grab a rebound and then throw it ahead. Trae Young is, like, already just unbelievably talented at that. You surround him with guys that can run the floor, and he's going to create quick points for you all over the place. So, again, when it comes to him, take everything I just said with a full acknowledgement that I am all aboard the stand for Trae Young train here, but I do think he's going to be really good.
I hope so. And I, you know, look, again, I don't watch much college ball, but he had a fourth quarter in Summer League where I happened to be in the big gym at Thomas and Mac. It was the best passing quarter that I've seen anyone have in Summer League ever.
It's his best quality. It really is. He's an unbelievable passer.
Yeah, he was throwing Steve Nash lefty, righty, all sorts of passes all over the place. Anyway, so that's the Thunder. We're going to bring in Chris Herring, who's in studio here, to talk about the Rockets and Carmelo Anthony. Royce Young, hopefully we all get some downtime. Hopefully you get some family time. And you got an interesting team to cover again next year, my friend. Thanks for all your great work.
You bet, Zach. And safe travels overseas, of course.
Thank you. Welcome back to the Low Post Podcast. We're done with the Oklahoma City Thunder. Done. I'll see you in September, Oklahoma City Thunder. And by happy coincidence, Chris Herring, the great Chris Herring of 538, is in New York for some reason taking meetings. You're always taking meetings, having meetings. You're a very important person.
July, it's free agency.
It's still July. That's
taking
right.
meetings.
July 31st. Your free agency is persisting till July 31st. You're either restricted or
you're not good at basketball.
Poor Rodney Hood. It's just. Someone asked me about Rodney Hood yesterday. Like, what's going to happen with Rodney Hood? What's the offer going to be? I'm like, oh my God, Rodney Hood didn't sign yet. I forgot about Rodney Hood. It's been a rough year for Rodney. Chris Herring of 538. Your work is always must read. Thanks for popping in.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me on again.
You're wearing a Dodgers hat.
Yeah.
You a Dodgers fan?
I went to a Dodgers game as a kid. I don't know if I'd go as far as to call myself a fan. I'm that guy, not today, not even for a reason today. Normally, and my girlfriend tells me constantly, like, you don't need to match your hats with your shoes and stuff.
Wow!
So I'm not matching today the hat with anything, but a lot of times when I buy hats, like, I have, like, Mariner stuff because I've got stuff in aqua and teal. Not because I really love the Mariners or anything, but because I have stuff that's aqua and teal that matches the hat.
The Dodgers is a beautiful baseball hat. It's a really simple. Nice baseball
it's
hat.
It's simple.
The blue is nice. LA interlocking. It's just a nice baseball hat.
If I were a baseball fan, and I mean, I guess I'm like a pseudo White Sox fan that I know they're, you know, some point they'll win again. They won when I was in college. The Dodgers, if it weren't for the White Sox and if I actually cared enough, I think the Dodgers would probably be the team I root for. They've got some fun players on that team. Puig is really fun. They've got a beautiful baseball stadium that you get a chance to go there. I've been, like, dying to get back there to watch a baseball game.
I went once many years ago. I don't remember it very well. I was a kid.
Yeah, I was too, but I still remember it. I guess I was probably old enough to remember. But they spend money. They put out a pretty decent product most of the time. I don't know. I probably would root for them, but I've been in a place where I really don't care much about baseball, which is sad because that was the closest thing to kind of my sport in high school. And I don't know why. It's just a slow sport now. It's just really hard to watch a full game. It's a good sport to have a conversation over if you go to the game because you don't feel like you're missing anything, whereas with football and
basketball. I don't understand how I used to have 4.5 hours to watch a Red Sox-Yankees 10-8.
Right.
It's like, how did I have this much time? I don't understand.
I don't anymore, and I just don't find myself watching full games anymore.
I also used to be the guy who would try to sell baseball to whatever girl I was dating. So we'd watch a game, and the pitcher would like throw 4 pickoff moves in a row over to first. I'd be like, no, honey, every one of those, crucial. Like every inch that base runner is back towards first, absolutely crucial. I guess that's mansplaining. I guess that's what the kids call mansplaining now. I would call it fansplaining. Doesn't matter if I'm a man and the target of my explanation is a woman. I'm just trying to educate about baseball at that point. And now I'm like, will you just pitch? Like, can we just get going?
It's bad. I mean, and the fans even boo the pickoff moves after a few times, even after one time if it's, you know, the road team. But, I have to stop myself from, I don't know. My girlfriend is not the biggest basketball person. She knew I was coming in for the podcast today, and she was like, I want to do the podcast. And I was like, what do you know about any of the stuff that he's going to have me on about? She's like, I know Carmelo Anthony. And I was like, well, what team does he play for? Which is kind of a trick question, given that he hasn't really signed anywhere yet.
Yeah.
And so she was like, he plays for – he's not on the Knicks anymore. So then she's like, he plays for the Denver – and she was trying to think of the name. I was like, not quite.
Used to.
Not I said used guess. To, so at least it was in the ballpark. And then she was like, tell me who he plays with. And I was like, he plays for Houston. And she was like, and I was like, which players on the team? She kind of knew some of the stuff. I was impressed. She knew about Yao Ming's history. I was like, that's good enough.
She could come on in. It's almost August, man. We could just like anything goes.
I'm going to tell her at this point. She's going to wreck your podcast.
Anything goes. My wife threatened to come on yesterday. I was trying last week to get a player who was in town to come on, and I could not do that. And if he said no, and she said, well, you know what? If you need me, I'll give you
pinch
some
hitter.
Time.
Baseball, you know? Back to baseball, pinch
and,
hitter.
And she would, her analysis is
the thing is,
spot on.
I've seen this stuff on Twitter. I've seen you, the one about your daughter when you were in the middle of the interview was just great. But
Mr. Poop. Yeah, when called Rick Carlisle, Mr. Poop. I was actually like legitimately frightened for half a second that he was going to be upset.
I'll be honest. I've tweeted sometimes about my, not run-ins, but my instances of interviewing Pop and Rick Carlisle's on that list too. Something about the Texas coaches, D'Antoni is on this list as well. They always make fun of my questions. Now I tend to get really great responses and it's in fun, so I don't mind it. But Carlisle, I wrote a piece a couple of years ago about players that lie about how tall they are. Kevin Durant gave me this fantastic quote about how he tells women that he's 7 feet tall and tells the rest of us he's 6'9". It was one of the more fun stories I've done. I went to Dallas to talk to J.J. Barea because I'm pretty sure when he first came into the league, he might still be listed. He's listed at 6 feet tall, which if you've ever stood next to J.J. Barea, it's not even close. I might be taller than he is, and I'm maybe 5'9", maybe 5'10". And he, you know, he was telling me how that happened, and he was like, I never told them to do that, but I saw it and immediately realized it was wrong. I asked Rick Carlisle about it. He's like, why are you asking me this question? And he and Pop just have this icy stare, but I think I've learned now with Pop, you ask him outside the box questions, he actually generally responds pretty well, at least to mine. But Carlisle does not play that game very well.
My daughter knows who LeBron is now, except she calls him LeBrunch. She'll see him on TV and say, oh, there's a LeBrunch. No, LeBron. LeBron. LeBrunch.
LeBrunch is way more fun.
Let's talk about Carmelo, because he's going to be on the Rockets now, unless something crazy happens. And it is assumed that he will start because he objected so vehemently to the idea of not starting, which would make their starting lineup Chris Paul, James Harden, Carmelo Anthony, PJ Tucker, and Clint Capella. I actually don't think it's 100% guaranteed that he starts.
That's interesting.
Don't think it's 100% guaranteed that he starts.
Good way to start that marriage if he doesn't.
Well, look, if they get they are trying to beat one team. Now, they got to beat a lot of other good teams in the West, but they're trying to beat one team. And against that team, when they got their best players on the court, he cannot be on the court.
It's
just not going to happen. When they have their little cute beginning of the second and fourth quarter lineups out there with, you know, David West or not anymore, but whoever is going to be filling these roles this year, he can be on the court and he can be effective, but he can't be on the court when they got their best players on the floor. Everyone is assuming, and I wrote this in my free agency wrap up, which feels like it came out a month, six months ago now. I just be very careful calling the Rockets losers. Because the last time we jumped all over the Rockets was when Parsons walked, they didn't get Bosh, LeBron changed teams that summer too, Ariza was the consolation prize. Turns out, like, now the not getting Bosh thing cost them a first round pick and all this, but like, I assume that the Rockets are prepared for a lot of different contingencies and will be okay. I think James Ennis, who probably only half the listeners of this podcast have even heard of, and this is a hardcore NBA podcast, I think he'll be good for them.
He'll be a good fit.
He'll duplicate 85% of what Trevor Ariza did.
I think that potentially makes him a much better fit than Melo, though. And that's the problem that I have, is that I could see Ennis being in a lot of game-ending lineups for them where Melo, and maybe should be in a lot of game-ending lineups for them where Melo shouldn't be. And that's what I'm curious about, is like, if you're up by 5 points, can you leave Melo in a game?
This is Mike D'Antoni's vengeance. This is a slowly plotted, like 10 steps ahead. We're going to get Melo all these years later. All these years after he didn't want to let Jeremy Lin cook and sabotage my career.
This is the Godfather.
And we're going to bench him for James
Ennis. This is the Godfather where Vito Corleone comes back and gets the guy that got his dad.
You know, this is
the same thing. So I just don't. I don't know. I wrote a piece on it. It's funny. I wrote a separate piece for 538, kind of a winners and losers column. I mentioned the Rockets as a loser, which maybe was a step too far. I see, and I had also written the piece on Melo saying, if it works, here's how it can work and here's why it would work. But even with that, there's a grain of salt in the sense that you know there are certain elements of it that are not going to work.
Right.
Well, I can't see them working.
I don't think it's unfair to label them a tentative loser now, because – look, it's very easy to say Bob Mute is easily replaceable, but when he injured his shoulder, he no longer could do anything.
Right.
And if there's a team that knows how that shoulder is and will be next year, it's the Rockets, and they chose not to re-sign him. And we'll get to the money in that in a second. Ariza, they were just never going to pay. It's 100% Daryl Morey's playbook to say, oh, you're a 3-and-D wing that's 33 and declining. We can definitely get 85% of you for the minimum, and that's what happened. Now, and I've written this before, that 15% can be the whole thing. in the playoffs against the best teams. It can be the only thing that matters on the margins of, like, can you be on the floor or can you not against the best teams can be included and encapsulated by that 15% quality difference. But they're never going to go over the tax, or they're never going to pay multiples of the tax for Trevor Ariza. It was just never going to happen. They are going to get another wing. It's going to happen.
Bazemore, someone that they're looking at, you'd be better, more knowledgeable about that. I don't quite see how that would work. I guess they'd have to get off of Anderson to be able to make that happen.
Well, okay. So we'll get to that. But all this stuff about me cautioning, labeling them a loser, they're trying to beat one team, and Ariza and Tucker and Bamute gave them the grit and the switchability to have a shot at defending that team. Now, you only got to defend them well enough to win four games. And your offense is so good that you only maybe have to defend them actually well by the numbers, like twice.
Right.
They almost did it. Yeah. It almost happened. And they've lost a lot of that identity in those two guys going out the door. Ennis's ability to duplicate it is TBD. Melo cannot do what they did. You cannot say, Melo, switch from Clay to KD to Steph. No, it's not going to happen. You'll be dead. He will get his ankles, what is left of them, broken. They've lost a certain toughness and switchability and all that. I do think they'll get a wing. To your point, Bazemore was rumored today. I think the package would be Ryan Anderson in their first round pick. And Ryan Anderson has 2 years at about 21 a pop left or something like that. And Bazemore has 2 years at like 18 and 19 or something like that. Is a better player. And so they'll say, hey, salaries are about the same. You're taking on a little more. Is the 29th pick or whatever it's going to be, is that enough? And I think they'll kick that around. I've heard they've talked to the Heat. Heat are kicking a lot of tires. I can't figure out what they're trying to do, but I could see like Tyler Johnson, same package, same idea. 2 years of salary left at about the same number. One guy is a better fit for the Warriors. One guy is not. Is our first round pick to a team that is out a future first round pick in Miami, is that good enough? I've heard they've kicked the tires on J.R. Smith. How about that?
Ugh.
That'd be good.
Oh, boy.
But all of these guys are and Bazemore, I think Bazemore is actually underrated as an offensive player and overrated as a defender. I think he doesn't have the size and the toughness and the physicality of the guys they lost. So it's all imperfect. But it's just like you can't – the perfect isn't always there. Like perfect isn't – prime Trevor Ariza is not there at whatever price they can pay.
Like you just said, I mean, I understood Ariza walking out the door and letting him do that for that kind of money. You have to bank on the fact that you've got a great executive that other teams want. You know, we saw the Philly report.
That was amazing.
Just ballsy, you think about it. It's like, man, let's just ignore what happened with Hinkie and the fact that Hinkie and Morey have a great relationship. Anyway, you can't pay Ariza that kind of money. I get it. When you look at the fact that Bamute is leaving for that kind of money, that's where what you just said a few minutes ago comes into play, where like you don't trust that this guy can get back to where he was physically, because he had a really solid regular season.
It was good for them.
Very good. And that was kind of an underrated part of that series, where he was hurt, couldn't make layups in the series at times against the Warriors. But
at all times.
It was bad. I mean, you can't really play a game with only four guys that can do something on offense against the Warriors. You need everybody out there. You need the spacing to be able to attack the way that they want to with their one-on-one. So,
and by the way, TBD if Ennis is up to it. He's actually not shot a lot of three-pointers in his NBA career.
And hasn't been great at them either. I think he's a little below average.
He had one really good year in Memphis in 16-17. Right. He's 38% from the corners for his career, 32 or 33 overall.
Yeah.
Like, you put him, Tucker, Capella on the floor, is there enough shooting? Is that really that demonstrably different from Ariza, Tucker, Capella?
Sure.
It's not like Ariza is a knockdown three-point shooter. He's an okay three-point shooter. We'll see.
My thing, getting back to the original question, is Carmelo going to be anywhere near a knockdown shooter either? And I mean, that's my thing, is if we're talking about Ennis, at least Ennis can defend some, fits enough of the prototype. Like you said, if he's 85% of Ariza, fits enough of the 3-and-D prototype that you want out there. Carmelo, on the other hand, there's not much defense to be had. And
the occasional swipe. I love the Melo swipes.
He and I talked about that several times.
The swipe block. I love that.
He used to get really upset because he gets a lot of blocks that way. That I don't know if it was 12-13, the really good season he had where he won the scoring crown, or if it was the year after, where he used that swipe all the time. And he'd get whistled. And a lot of times they would miss, they would blow the whistle on him for a foul, and he hadn't actually hit the guy. But it looks like he's fouling someone because he's just swiping.
It's a clothesline.
And sometimes he has clothesline people too. And even the way he goes in and kind of rebounds and hugs people sometimes. Watch him when he's there on the block for a free throw attempt that someone's taking. And he kind of wrestles with people a little bit. He's a physical guy, and it's like he doesn't, It feels like he doesn't try to even trick refs as to kind of what he's doing, but there's not going to be enough defense there. If he's just an average 3-point shooter, like to me, and you look at his numbers last year and he was like below replacement level statistically, it makes sense when you watch the way the guy gets attacked on defense, especially in the Utah series, which I wrote a little bit about that in my
piece.
And
it's not as if Utah had like this incredible, I mean, Mitchell had some incredible games in that series, but it's not as if you're cycling between three all-star ball handlers that
Alec
are going to break you down on the pick and roll.
Yeah, just different guys. I mean, Mitchell definitely had a field day when Melo switched on to him, but I mean, it's Alec Burks, it's Ingles, it's like pretty much take your pick. But I looked at it and the numbers, I think it was almost 1.25 points per possession that they got when they forced Melo to switch in that series. And I think when you look at the guys that were, volume shooters, volume scorers, for the regular season, the best scorer in the league efficiency-wise was Durant at 1.15. And so we're talking about basically someone scoring more efficiently than Durant did in the regular season every time you get Melo in a situation
like
that.
That was a mean stat you picked out there. That was mean.
It was mean, but we got access to everything now, man. I gotta come with the best ammo I've got. But I think he's trying. It's not that he's not trying. Sometimes you can definitely rip Melo for the effort. And sometimes you talk about the idea of switching needlessly. I don't think that's what this was. They're gonna pick and roll enough times until you get the matchup you want. And Melo just wasn't really capable of stopping, and sometimes help was late. But, that was also a much different defensive team once they lost Robertson, too. But that said, I mean, this team, if they lose Tucker, what do you do defensively with this team?
Oh, you're done. That's it.
I know. And that's the problem, is that there was a little bit of depth there last year. A little bit. Not a lot. Not that they – I mean, we saw the playoff series where they're running 6 and 7 guys out there. And Bamute goes down or is hurt, and you don't feel like you can use him, all of a sudden your depth is shot. But now it's just kind of like the players are so different in some cases. Melo's so different than what they had that it just feels like you're hoping for a lot here. You're hoping for him to shoot better. And that was the other thing I touched on in my story, is that if it works for them, I think part of it is going to be because Melo shoots better. He's got better passers shuttling the ball to him than what he had with Russell.
Yeah, and they are counting on that. You talk to the Rockets, they'll say, well, we have two of the 4 or 5 best passers in the entire world.
They do.
And so his life is going to be easier on every level. The ball is going to come to the pocket every time, and it's going to come on time and on target and all that. How many years? Melo's played 15 seasons? Could that possibly be right?
I mean, same 14 as LeBron. 14, yeah.
How many times do you think Melo has shot over 40% from three, Chris Herring?
One.
That's correct.
I've studied the numbers, man. I know.
So I've studied a lot of numbers.
402? Am I wrong? 407, 402.
402.
Okay.
40.2% in, do you remember which season?
It was the 13-14 season. Or
yes.
Okay.
Correct.
Let's go.
His last four seasons from three since then, 35.7, 35.9, 33.9, 34.1.
Average.
He's just an average 3-point shooter in the NBA. Houston would gladly sign up for 36% from three, knowing that would mean on open catch and shoot threes, he's probably up around 39 or 40 because you're going to bake in some bad ones. They would that point per possession, that's totally fine for them. Can he survive defensively against the Warriors? No, but to Bamute, Clippers sign him for 1 year, $4.3 million, I believe is the number.
Right.
That is more than the Rockets could have offered him without dipping into their mid-level exception, which means they've made a calculated decision. We are valuing the possibility of somebody we might be able to get down the line with our mid-level, our tax mid-level, which is whatever it is, over what Mbamute can give us, which means unless there's someone I'm forgetting about now, they're thinking about who's going to get bought out in the middle of the season. And I think if they don't trade, I think that there might be a couple of interesting. My personal favorite buyout for them would be Damari Carroll, of like realistic guys.
Boy. Yeah.
And that would, I don't think Brooklyn's dying to buy out Damari Carroll. They like him.
He was a great
locker room guy for them last year. They also sold the idea when they acquired him of, yes, we've paid $31 million in salary for what is going to be a bad pick, became the 29th pick. But we believe we can rehabilitate his trade value and flip him for positive value down the line. I don't think that is going to happen at this point. And I could see everyone agreeing, hey, we stink again because we haven't had a draft pick in 17 years. you want to play for a contender. Yeah, let's make it happen. That's one I could see. And there are a few others. So they'll get one by hook or by crook, they are going to get another wing that can play passable defense.
And my only thing, with every name you mentioned, we've talked about Ennis now. We've talked about the idea of Bazemore. We've talked about Damari Carroll. Who doesn't like Damari Carroll, unless maybe you're a Toronto fan? All these guys, to me, just sound like they'd probably fit better than Melo. And that's, you know, having watched the guy up close for that long and knowing how the kind of hot pursuit that the Rockets were in last year of Melo, and now to get him, they clearly still wanted him. I mean, so this is a smart organization. They know what they're doing, either totally or for the most part. It just, I don't know. There's something about this that just, like I said, if it works, I feel like it'll work partially. I don't see it being just a home run acquisition for them. And I don't know that they, if they're being honest with themselves, would consider that either.
I think they see a guy who will make a decent amount of open threes, have quarters where he carries the offense and cooks a little bit. And maybe that means you could experiment with not staggering Harden and Paul quite as rigidly as you did last year. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you. I don't think it's a home run. One thing I do think they'll do more is play the three guards together, Paul, Harden, and Gordon. I think that will be a look. I think they like that look without the security blanket of Ariza, who was like, not only was he good, he was an Iron Man. I mean, he played every game. He played like 35 minutes, 40 if you needed him. He played all the time. Regular season, Harden, Paul, Gordon, which seems like it's too undersized and is, 148 minutes, 135 points per 100 possessions, which is essentially just human flame, and 106 allowed, so plus a gargantuan number. But in only 148 minutes, which
that's
is not, nothing.
Really small.
Playoffs, they played 137 in the playoffs alone.
Wow.
So that's clearly part of that is what happened to Bamute and, you know, do you trust Gerald Green to defend against good teams? No, you can't. But I think that's a look that we might see more.
That's interesting. I mean, they're going to need something. I mean, the thing that we didn't see as much of because of, like you said, he vehemently said, I'm not doing this, coming off the bench. If he does that, I mean, that in some ways, he still would probably play a decent amount with Paul because of the fact that they stagger those guys the way they do. There's that. There's the idea that if he still wants to kind of do his one-on-one thing, which he does, he could probably do that, and it probably fits a little bit better in the second unit. I don't know. Maybe it fits in the first unit sometimes too, because this is a team that likes to go one-on-one and likes to make use of the looks that it gets. But that's the only thing that, you know, he wasn't as open to, and that's kind of where I'm at from a career perspective now, is that you know, I'd love to see Melo win something significant, because I mean, he's done it, but not at the NBA level. And to me, the thing that doesn't really jibe particularly well, he talks about not understanding why it hasn't worked out for him. He talks about, I mean, I remember the, not low point, but the thing that he said that I was like, wow, that kind of hit hard, or that was kind of deep, as far as we talked to him in Vegas a couple years ago during, before they went to the Olympics, and he talked about the idea that he was there and LeBron wasn't, because LeBron had decided he was done with Olympic stuff. And Carmelo, they're kind of asking Carmelo, like, why is it so important for you to do it? You know, since LeBron's not here and you guys came in together and now LeBron's not doing it anymore. He was like, well, you know, LeBron's kind of had a different trajectory to his career where he's, you know, he's won and he's gone to the finals every single year. I don't have that. And so basically saying, like, I'm kind of stacking the accomplishments on top of each other that I can in lieu of the fact that I haven't reached the promised land as far as the NBA is concerned. And I was like, wow, it's really honest that he said that. The fact that he wanted to be the first guy to play in the Olympics four times for the U.S. But he's also not always putting himself in an ideal position. Like, if you're going to put your team situation and the idea of winning a title above everything else, you can't be out there saying, like, no, I know the kind of player I am, and I'm not going to be a sixth man. Why not?
Like, now, by the way, I implied earlier that I'm not sure it's 100% set that he's going to start in Houston. I think I don't know that anything's 100% set. My guess is everyone's going into this with eyes wide open. If I had to, I bet he starts. I think he'll start. I also don't understand why it's so hard for teams to just say, you know what, you're going to start against everybody but the Warriors. Now, I get that you've got to build lineup cohesion and all this, but if I had to predict, I would say he starts the season starting, and at some point they say, let's see what it looks like, much like they did with Ryan Anderson, but not banishing him.
Okay.
But let's see what it looks like. See what it looks like. And I bet they convince him to try.
I mean, there was a portion of the season where, and I'm not plugged in. I mean, the guy you just had on with Royce, he would know. There was a point during the Oklahoma City season where it kind of seemed like it would have made sense to try that. And a lot of people felt like it was right around the time, you know, Melo made his first trip back to the Garden, did not have a good game at all.
Did not play well.
But a lot of people were saying, okay, now he's gotten that out of his system. He's played the game where you want to have him honored before the game to start. The Knicks did the whole nice thing for him. You let him start there so that he can kind of take in the warmness of the fans that, you know, that want to appreciate him. After that, you pull him off the bench and you let him try to find his way there, because he actually could be really effective there with a team that doesn't have a whole lot of bench punch, you know, and they didn't do it. And instead, you know, Billy Donovan kind of made it a conversation about the idea of making Melo more of a complimentary guy or a supplementary guy as far as being catch and shoot. And, you know, up to that point, Melo was still isolating a lot and was still trying to jab step his way into baskets, and then trying to get him to take the role that we all figured he was going to take when he got there anyway, as Olympic Melo. And so that should have happened there, and maybe it would be more easy to accept if it had happened there. Most people would take it as kind of a humbling sort of thing that, granted, they have a massive luxury payment they're going to have to make, a massive luxury payment they're going to have to make if Carmelo stays there. He wasn't good enough to justify that. It didn't seem like Carmelo was in love with the plan they had for him. Maybe they were going to ask him to come off the bench if he came back. It seems like that was likely. But why not just, you know, like you said, why don't teams just say that? I guess I understand it. Why don't players just accept it? He's a Hall of Famer. He's been successful at every level. He's won a scoring crown. I guess it is very difficult to accept. But if the trade-off is that, and you're going to a team that was within 12 minutes of making it to the NBA Finals, like, what's the issue? Why not?
Or you start and you are a more important version of Keith Bogans was to the Bulls.
15-minute, 20-minute game starter.
Well, you're out after 4 minutes, and you'll come back in for a longer stretch when the other team's bench is in.
And you don't finish the game.
And you may not finish the game.
Yeah.
But you still start. You still get your name announced, you know.
Hell, I don't know. Maybe it's been too long since I played basketball, you know. But finishing a game seems like it would matter more to me than starting it. Everybody's different. He's never come off the bench even a single time in his career. I know he did during the Olympic run, but I don't know. Let me not get in the guy's head too much. The thing is, if winning matters most, and everybody is going to say that it does, at a certain point, don't you kind of have to bend a little bit on that? If you're joining a team that, what did they win, 65 games last year?
And if they're healthy, changes all this status quo now. They don't get another wing. I still think they're the second best team in the West, and it's not close.
Yeah.
And with the potential to, again, be the first seed, because the Warriors will, you know, do whatever they do.
I guess it's just that they, you know, like I said, I called them one of the losers of the summer, the other team in the Blazers. probably because I felt like, man, they were so close. And even if they can't close the gap, don't lose ground. And I guess with this pickup, I just, you know, losing the guys you lost, I, and this is going to have Rockets fans coming after me. I, like we said, you wouldn't keep Ariza at that money, but let's say all things were equal. Wouldn't you rather have Ariza or just have Mbamute over Melo? I don't know.
I don't know. Probably not. Well,
within the team context, if you're playing him with
it's
Tucker,
it's not crazy.
I might do it.
Ariza, yes.
Ariza for sure. I mean, Mbamute, I guess with the understanding that he's going to be playing alongside Tucker and it allows you to switch still. But I don't know. Maybe that makes me crazy, especially having covered the guy up close for that long.
I'm glad you called him a Hall of Famer, though.
He's absolutely. I mean, people are arguing that aren't looking at what the thresholds have been. The number of All-Star games alone that he's been
He's
to,
a Hall of Famer. It's
everybody.
Done, period.
He's won a scoring crown. He won an
You could retire right now and he'd be in the Hall of Famer.
People don't want to you know, pay attention to the fact that he won a national title and carried a team. Like, it's the Basketball Hall of Fame. It's not the NBA Hall of Fame.
I do think he was overrated for almost his entire career. But he's a Hall of Famer. I think it's very important. This is very, very important. He was not on the banana boat. That needs to be made clear. He was not on the banana boat. I keep seeing him photoshopped on the banana boat, talked about as if he was on the banana. Maybe he was on the banana boat at a separate time that has not been documented. He was not on the banana boat. And someone photoshopped James Harden on. James Harden does not get to just go on the banana boat. The banana boat is Chris Paul, LeBron, Dwayne Wade, and Gabriel Union.
Yep.
That's the banana boat.
Yep.
Carmelo, I guess, took the picture. I don't know where Carmelo was. He was not on the banana boat. And this is, it's too important. The banana boat is too important to trivialize and make mistakes about. It's too important a piece of recent NBA history. Carmelo was not on the banana boat.
I'm getting deep here for no reason. That was emblematic of his career, though, because...
Not being on the banana boat?
Yes, because at one point, and I can't remember where I read it. I'm sure it was ESPN.
I'm going to stop you right now. You should write this piece for 538. If this is how the banana boat represents Carmelo Anthony's career.
I do this so much, like, between this and Twitter, where I espouse all these ideas, and then, like, man, I really shouldn't have said that out loud before I wrote it, but that's okay. Someone else will just have a really nice come up, or it's already been said. Whoever wrote it, it's already been written, so I wouldn't be the first one. LeBron, you know, Brian Windhorst wrote this great piece before he was even at ESPN, I think, about the fact that these conversations about the big three in Miami happened well before that ever happened. And the idea that because they're all part of the same draft class that I think LeBron and Wade both wanted to partner with Melo specifically, but the idea that Melo, who has often put money, you know, made money a huge priority in his career, and you know, that's his right to do that. I don't have any issue with that. But the idea that he took an extension, or there was something that he did with his contract that was different than what Wade and LeBron did with their contract.
Longer.
So he went longer, and in doing that, might have gotten more money up front, but they were able to hit free agency at a different time than he did. That was kind of his shot. Like, they think about it. I don't know if they would have won the two titles that they won if you have Melo instead of Bosch, because there were a whole lot of things that defensively would have been really untenable that way. I don't know. Maybe he was younger. Maybe he could have done it. But, I mean, he could have had a title by now if he, you know, different decisions that he'd made. You know, the Oklahoma City thing, I'm not really going to blame him for, but, you know, they weren't going to win a title with that team over Golden State or anything. But just like I just wish he'd be a little bit more flexible with some of this stuff. Now you're in the, you know, kind of the twilight years of your career, the twilight of your career. You kind of have to bend a little bit to try to get there. I don't necessarily know that being a starter is going to matter at the end of the day if you're a contributor to a team that wins a title. What difference does it make?
Do you think you would have worn a headband on the banana boat?
I've hung out with him enough to know that he doesn't wear headbands when he's not playing basketball. When he's off the court, he does not wear headbands. So I would assume he wouldn't.
Okay.
I don't think he would. Maybe.
Do you think he would have taken Gabrielle's place at the front of the banana boat, or do you think he would have gone into a different position on the banana boat? She was at the front.
It was her, and then – so I guess it had to have been Wade.
And then CP.
And then LeBron was at the back.
LeBron's the anchor.
I don't know where he would have sat. I feel like I've talked to him before about where he sits on roller coasters.
What?
I've talked to him about a lot of stuff, man, like dinners and like I'm trying to think when we would have had that conversation. I remember I think I've told you maybe on this podcast that my roommate when I lived here in New York ran into him at a video game store right before the hurricane that was Sandy and Mello was going to be bored, and so he went in to go buy a video game. We've talked about how he likes to sleep in when the rest of his teammates like go sightseeing in different cities, particularly when they had the preseason games and stuff or games in London. I don't know. We've talked about a lot of weird random stuff, but I can't remember if we – I think we talked about roller coaster stuff, but I don't remember if you
told me. I don't like roller coasters.
You don't – what?
Don't like roller coasters.
Well, let me not act like that's that foreign. I mean, they're
– I don't mind. I'll go on them. They're fine. Some of them I like. Like when we get – what I really do not like – and I mean viscerally do not like is the slow climb up. I can't handle it.
I like it, but I could see how you would.
Fast stuff, the upside down stuff, I'm cool with that. It's the slow climb up.
All these years that we had in Cleveland, we've had four of them now. You never went to Cedar Point during the finals?
I don't even know what that is.
What the hell, Zach?
That's an amusement park?
It's like the amusement – it's one of three things that's worth actually doing or seeing in Ohio.
Whoa, whoa.
And I lived in Cleveland. I like Cleveland as a city. I actually enjoyed being in Cleveland, which that's going a lot farther than most people, especially as a Michigan alum. I like Cleveland.
Okay.
I like Ohio more than most people. I've lived there.
Even though there are only, for the record, three things worth doing in Ohio?
Did I stutter? I mean, Cedar Point would hands down be one of the three things that most people.
What are the
mention.
Other two?
I like Cleveland. I mean,
Cleveland is one thing.
No. I mean, let me think
Cleveland
about this
is too broad. To
I
be a
like
thing.
I like lakes.
Okay.
Now, their lake was set on fire, caught on fire. But I like the lake. I like running there. I'm trying to think what else. They got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which is really cool. I like music. I do not like Ohio State. I feel like most people there would be very proud of that. I'm a big Michigan person. But anyway, Cedar Point is basically – you probably wouldn't like it because it's a real thrill seekers amusement park
out.
Because they have at least two or three of the fastest roller coasters in the country. So it's
fast. I don't mind. I don't mind fast.
But generally speaking,
I like turns.
To get fast, you normally have to climb up.
Do we have to go up so slowly? Is what I'm saying.
You're
enjoying the tension. The tension of going straight up.
Come
I don't
to
like
Chicago.
That.
You would like some of the ones they've got at Six Flags because they've got vertical velocity that just you start out and you literally just go up. And you come back down, but you start at like 60 miles an hour, which is really cool.
Okay.
And it's very quick. It's over in probably 45 seconds, but it's very, very
fun. I'm fine with that.
So you'd probably like that. Now, you would not like some of the other roller coasters there, but you're not alone in that. What I will tell you, since we're on the subject of thrill seeking, and I went rock climbing for the first time since my childhood on Sunday. And let me tell you, I did not make it more than halfway up the wall. I had this constant fear. I don't even have the biggest feet. I'm like a size 10 and a half, 11. That my feet were not going to stay on the blocks. And, you know, I'm sitting here like, how are you not doing roller coasters? And my girlfriend's sitting there looking at me like, how are you not able to climb up the wall? So everybody's got their things. I don't know how to swim. We've all got our things that we either just won't try.
You couldn't go on the banana boat.
Probably not. I probably would have been afraid. I tried to learn how to swim. I tried very hard to learn how to swim in high school. I literally took a honors gym class. In my high school. My high school is so weird.
Honors gym?
Honors gym.
All you had to do for gym in my high school was show up. And if you were a varsity athlete, you didn't have to do that.
We had a bunch of preppy people that were like really worried about getting into good schools, which I guess is not a bad thing at all that you would worry about that. But a lot of people that were saying that gym was ruining their GPA and that they...
Wow.
So they... Because we had a four-point skill. They're like, if I take this... There's an honor skill that's worth 6 points. They're like, if I take gym and it's just an average level class, then I'm only going to get a 4 or a 5 on a 6-point scale. So they had to offer honors level gym where you help the instructor. You learn how to help the instructor and be a teacher's assistant, but you have to be in good physical fitness to do it. And so they can actually grade you on your ability to run a certain time to be able to do certain things. And so swimming was one of them. And I was like, oh, this is great because I'm going to have to learn how to swim. Otherwise, I'm going to fail the class. So I was pushing myself to learn how to swim as a junior or senior in high school. And I literally, my gym instructor was literally the swimming and diving coach. And I tried for 3 weeks and could not do it. They even put the flippers on me and everything. I could not get to the other end of the pool. So I don't know. I try and fail at a lot of things. I'm a decent athlete. I was a decent athlete in high school, but not so much with certain things, I guess.
You want to hear an interesting tidbit about the Rockets?
Let's hear it.
If they traded their first-round pick, as we're speculating they might, that would be five first-round picks in a row they've traded.
Their history, I think it's them. I remember I was working on a piece about the Knicks at one point when I was on the beat about how they never make use of their picks they trade their picks away whenever they can.
They did it correctly. Like, they built the team. They traded a bunch of picks and young players to get James Harden. Then they use their picks, and then they got even better. And now they're in the phase of, we're just trying to win.
No, like, exactly. Yeah. So it's them. Basically, what I was saying is that when I thought that the Knicks would be the team that, like, never keeps their picks and does that more than anyone, it was actually the Rockets and I think the Mavericks.
Capella right now is the most recent Rockets first-round pick on the roster.
And he's been in the league, what,
2014
years?
Draft.
Yeah.
15 pick they traded to dump Lynn. Remember they had to dump Lynn to open up cap space for Bosch?
That was a crazy.
Didn't work out.
Yeah.
Now they got Sam Decker. They got the pick that became Sam Decker from the Pelicans in the Oshik Ariza three-way deal. So that kind of counts. 16 pick. If you can remember who they traded the 2016 first-round pick, I will applaud you.
This isn't a mellow statistic, so I don't have it memorized as well.
I had to go back and check.
You said 2016. The 16th pick, and who they traded.
No, 2016, whatever they ended up wherever they ended up picking, they traded that pick for somebody. 2017, they traded for Lou Williams. 2018, they traded for Chris Paul. 2016 was the one I had to go back and check.
I'm not going to think of who it was.
He's out of the league right now.
Oh, so that's really not going to help. I'm not going to think of who it was.
Ty Lawson.
Wow. Wow, I forgot about that. Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, Daryl's taken a fair amount of criticism for it, the idea that you just bring in these stars or these players that have been good, you know, in a past career without regard for fit, which I think is a little bit unfair. But also you need stars to win. And at this point, I don't mind them going all in at this point, because let's be real. If you don't get it done in the next.
This is it.
I mean, Chris Paul has maybe another good year or two left, I would think, to where he's at this level. And even then, I mean, the injuries, we've already seen them creep in several times in his career. You got to go for it now. So I don't mind it. Now, what I will say, and every time I've said this, people have kind of been like, are you serious? Do you know Tillman Fertitta? I'm a little bit surprised at how seemingly afraid of the luxury tax they've been. Obviously, Ariza, you weren't going to do that. I guess I've had to think about it a little bit more since you've talked about Mbamute, the idea that maybe that's just, you know, fundamentally we don't know that he has a lot left, or we don't know that he's going to be totally right with the shoulder thing. But I don't know. I guess to me, when he bought that team, maybe it was just spoiled from the previous owner and the fact that, you know, Alexander was always going to pay what he had to. I just keep hearing that maybe Tillman Fertitta is not necessarily that way, which, knowing how much money he has, surprises me just a little bit.
Well, you know, they're already at 137.
It's high.
Now that Capella's back on a good deal. Although I think that deal it's being framed as a steal for the Rockets. And I do think at 5 years, 80 with incentives to 90, it's a good deal for the Rockets. But I think given the market for centers now, and that he was restricted, and what the market for centers figures to be next year,
it's a good deal. But
it's
not,
fine. Yeah. It's fine for Clint Capella.
You know what I keep thinking too with that? Because I kept thinking the same thing. I'm like, am I missing something here? God forbid something happened to Harden. I mean, like, we part of the reason he wasn't going to get more than what he got is the idea that, like, this fit for him is ideal. It is literally perfect in a way that other teams probably wouldn't provide for him. Like I said, God forbid something happened to Harden. I mean, he's still a decent player, but he's not of the same value at that point. If anything happens to Harden, if Paul doesn't age, you know, if he does start to slow down, which at some point he will, if he's not as effective on offense as he has been, I mean, defensively, he's good. He's not great defensively. He's good. And if you take away some of the factors that make him very good at times, then I just don't know that he's worth even what they gave him.
I don't know what I was saying. Oh, they're at $137 million.
Oh.
So they're something like 13 over the tax. So Ariza at that number is going to cost them lots and lots of money, multiples of his salary. I've said this before, like, I just don't think they are going to beat the Warriors without a lot of Clint Capela minutes. I just think they're not going to out five out the Warriors. They need his rim protection. It's something that no one else on their team can duplicate. And the Warriors, for as many threes as they shoot, go to the rim in the mid-range and in a fair bit. I just think that's a dimension that they need.
He made some plays in that series. I mean, he obviously got beat sometimes too, but some plays in that series where he was dribble for dribble with Steph. And I don't know if he poked the ball away from Steph a couple times or just kind of got his hand on a shot, but played really good defense. I mean, both ways, both teams kind of had, you know, I was impressed with JaVale and kind of the way it seemed like he was bothering LeBron. Just sometimes you kind of have a play where you're like, I didn't know that guy was capable of that. And I watched the Rockets a decent amount very early on. I think there were a lot of analysts kind of in our shoes that said, you know, the Rockets, when they're this good on defense, they can push the Warriors. They obviously did that. Part of the reason they were able to do it was just because Capela has a lot of talent. You couldn't just replace him easily at all. You know, I know the Rockets have been good at identifying guys. I think, yeah, obviously some of what he does is very dependent on those two guards. But yeah, I was surprised that it was dragging out as long as it was once it became very clear that it's just the Rockets and Capela at this point. There's nobody else that really can make a play here. But I think the deal was fair. I didn't think that he was going to get way more than that. And I think if they'd gone way less than that, you know, anything less than 80, then there would have been a fair gripe to have for him.
Yeah. Any downtime? Any traveling coming up?
A bachelor party in Mexico, we'll see how that goes. But it's
you've done writing for 538. Now no one's coming back from a bachelor party in Mexico.
May not, it should be. I don't drink the most, so it shouldn't be too bad. But
well, this podcast has gone on long, but no, I'm out now for vacation. So
good. This is it. I thought you had already been on vacation, or that you had already at least.
It's a long story. I was supposed to be, but I'm not.
Maybe even editors and coworkers are like, yeah, Zach's on vacation next week, so I'll have a lot of time to talk about this, and this. And then I still see you pumping out, shaming the hell out of all of us with like stories about pregnancies and stories about the Bulls. And of course, we've talked about this before, the jealousy that I have that you get to a story 1 or 2 days before I do. Granted, with a ton more reporting than I have. You know, it's just so you need to go on vacation.
So I don't care that this podcast is an hour and 25 minutes or whatever it is, because I'm not doing any more for a while.
Okay. Enjoy your time.
I'm not doing any from there unless I run into some sort of Croatian athlete.
And, I mean, Howard Beck, unless he vacationed with Kerr, I saw him run into Steve Kerr in Ireland.
I don't think they vacationed together.
I don't think they do either, but the fact that they saw each other or arranged a meet up there, I'm like, don't y'all have. Let me not be mean. I was about to say, don't y'all have families to just hang out with? Like, don't y'all have stuff that you can do that's not related to basketball?
This is the first year in now several years where there, to my knowledge, there are no NBA people rolling through Dubrovnik while I'm there. Every year there's
really
just NBA people coming on vacation, and I end up going out to drinks or dinners with four or five scouts or front
really?
Office people because everyone wants to come to Croatia.
Now, do you go? Your wife's family is still over there?
The extended family.
Okay,
extended family.
Good. Well, you guys.
And she would get tired of like, really, you got another NBA person you gotta go see? I'm like, sorry.
Like, can't we get away from this but in any country?
But you know this. There's something different about when you hang out with someone in a foreign country. Your relationship changes. It's just there's something about like we're both in this now Croatia's familiar for me now, but like we're both in this unfamiliar place and we're together and like wow, we're drinking a beer in wherever, and you know it's true. It's good to do that.
Except basketball conversations in every country are exactly the same.
Yeah,
when you're running into people that are not your family, where the relationship is rooted in basketball. I can just see you guys here in the States.
Well, I should go home now and have my daughter yell at me before she goes to bed. She's been very irritable lately, as I discussed earlier on the
podcast. Don't want her going on a vacation.
Chris Herring, look at all his stuff at 538. He's had recent pieces on Kawhi Leonard, who we remarkably did not talk about at all, and Carmelo Anthony and many other things. Work is always top notch. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me on as always.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.